This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The Ice Bucket Challenge, raising funds for ALS research, continues to ripple through social media. Politicians, celebrities, and thousands upon thousands of regular folks have dumped ice-cold water on their heads and given varying amounts of money to the ALS Foundation. Researchers and doctors who focus on this degenerative disease have also taken part. Here's a video of the ALS team at Fletcher Allen in a video they posted to Facebook last week.
The ALS team at Fletcher Allen Healthcare and UVM accepts the Ice Water Challenge, and we challenge the ALS team at Dartmouth and the attendings at University of Vermont Fletcher Allen Healthcare to do the same.
One, two, three.
Dr. Roop Tandon is the main voice you heard in that clip. He's a neurologist who researches ALS. He's with Fletcher Allen Healthcare and the University of Vermont College of Medicine in Burlington, and he's one of our guests today. Dr. Tandon, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Jane.
We're also joined by Lisa Anderson, Vermont Care Services Coordinator for the ALS Association of Northern New England. Hello to you, Lisa.
Hi, Jane.
We're going to dispense with the frivolity of the Ice Bucket Challenge today and the many discussions that are swirling around about fundraising efficacy of that challenge. And instead, we want to focus on the disease itself and how it affects the people who are diagnosed with it, something that seems to have gotten largely lost in all of this publicity. If you have questions about amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or if you want to share your family's experience with the disease, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your experiences, your thoughts, or your questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. So this disease acts on the nervous system of the body, and it causes the nerve cells in a patient's body to rapidly degenerate and deteriorate. Dr. Tandon, could you explain first just what are the symptoms that a patient who's diagnosed with ALS experiences?
Yeah. So typically, the disease can either begin in the throat area, where there can be difficulty with speech or swallowing in folks, with episodes of choking, or it can begin with weakness in the muscles of the arms or the legs. So those people obviously have difficulty with functional activities related to involvement in the arms and legs. Rarely, it can begin with involvement of the respiratory muscles, so there can be difficulty with breathing at the very onset of the disease.
And is that typically when they come in to the doctor and say something is wrong and are diagnosed with ALS?
Yes. Typically, they would come to the doctor with either a history of slurred speech or difficulty with chewing or swallowing, or they may say that they have weakness of a hand or both hands or a foot with a foot drop on one side, or weakness of both legs, and that's when they come to their doctor.
Lisa Anderson, for the patients that you work with, what happens after that diagnosis? How does it progress?
Well, the patient eventually becomes completely paralyzed, and the caregiving needs of patients diagnosed with ALS are huge. And devastating on many levels, financially, emotionally.
What's the life expectancy of someone who has ALS?
2 to 5 years.
So in that 2 to 5 years, Dr. Tandon, what happens that actually leads to death? What's the usual cause of death?
Yeah. So even if the disease begins in a certain focal part of the body, like the throat or in the arms or the legs, it ultimately progresses to all muscles in the body. And in the majority of patients with ALS, death is due to respiratory failure. So because of weakness of their diaphragm or bellows predominantly and their chest wall muscles, so they progressively get more and more difficulty with breathing. Breathing becomes more encumbered. And ultimately, they start to retain carbon dioxide. They get respiratory failure. And that's the most important cause of death.
So it's not an infection that typically kills people. It's respiratory failure.
That's right.
And in the progression of this disease, your brain is still fully functional. So your body is deteriorating, but you can still think all of the thoughts that you thought before you had ALS. This does not affect the brain function?
This is the unfortunate part of this disease, that the brain retains its functions. Now, if you tested people for different aspects of brain function, there may be some abnormality you can detect on testing. But in general, for all practical purposes, they remain completely cognizant of what is going on around them.
So Lisa Anderson, can you talk a little bit about the emotional experience for people who are diagnosed with ALS and also the experience for their caregivers, their family members and loved ones?
Sure. As I said, it's absolutely devastating. It comes with a lot of depression and anxiety, the complete loss of independence, and it gets to the point where a person needs to be cared for almost every minute of the day. So the burden, so to speak, on the caregiver is tremendous. And unfortunately, health insurance isn't able to cover home health services 24/7. So that can be a huge hardship on a family.
What do they tell you about how hard this is?
Well, I worked with a patient who recently passed away, and he said, and I'll never forget it, he said, "This is a mean, mean disease." And that's what it is. It's mean.
How do they typically communicate with you once they lose the ability to speak and to use their body for functions that would typically allow them to communicate?
Well, usually folks work with a speech and language pathologist, and so an appropriate means of communication for them is recommended. And that can be high-tech through a device called a Dynavox, which costs somewhere around $20,000, or as simple as a letter board, where if a person has function of their hands, they can point to letters or common phrases, that sort of thing. But, you know, it eventually gets to the point where the only thing a person's able to move are their eyes, so they blink yes for no or two blinks for, yeah, so on.
We're talking today about ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. It's certainly been in the news a lot, but not a lot of people know how it actually affects patients and affects family members and caregivers. So we're learning more about that today with two experts in our region who have extensive experience with the disease. And if you have questions about how it works on the body or what kind of research is being done into this disease, what treatment options are available, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Dr. Rube Tandon is one of our guests today. He's a neurologist who researches ALS. And Dr. Tandon, can you go a little bit deeper into what's actually happening in this disease? I mean, we've talked a little bit about the symptoms, but what's the disease mechanism?
Yeah. So the other name for ALS is, of course, Lou Gehrig's disease. It's also called motor neuron disease in other parts of the world. So the motor neurons, or the nerve cells that control motor function or muscle function, degenerate in this disease. So there's a two-tier system of motor control. One is between the brain and the spinal cord, and the other is from the spinal cord to the muscles of the hands and the legs. Both those systems degenerate. The motor nerve cells in the brain and in the spinal cord degenerate.
And is that typically called the central nervous system and the other one is the peripheral nervous system, or do I have my terms confused?
No, I think you're right. You're right. The brain and spinal cord are referred to as the central nervous system, and then the nerves coming out of the spinal cord are referred to as the peripheral nervous system.
Okay.
So when the nerve cells degenerate in the spinal cord, then the nerves that arise from them also degenerate. And then when the muscles lose their nerve supply, the muscles degenerate secondarily. So it's a sort of a sequential degeneration of nerve cells, then the nerves that supply the muscles, and ultimately the muscles.
What are the theories behind the causes of this disease?
Yes. We don't know what exactly causes the disease, but we do know that in about maybe 10 to 15% of cases of the disease worldwide, it is inherited. So that kind of ALS is called familial ALS. So in the rest, maybe about 80 to 85% of cases, it is non-inherited, also called sporadic ALS. We know the genes that produce familial ALS. We know at least maybe 8 or 10 different genes that cause or are associated with familial ALS. We also know what goes awry partially in some of those cases of familial ALS in terms of what the basic mechanism is of disease production. The issue is that we don't know what exactly happens in the majority of the sporadic or non-familial cases of ALS. But there are many hypotheses and theories on that.
I'm going to ask you to explain them, but first let me take a call because we have some listeners who want to get in on this conversation and may have questions. Tim is calling in from South Burlington. Hi, Tim. Go right ahead.
Hi. How are you today?
Well, thanks. You?
Very good. Thank you. My grandfather died of ALS. He resided in Canada, and it was in 1964, one of the first Canadians diagnosed with ALS. And I'm wondering, I was told once that it skips generations. Now, my father and his brothers never had ALS. Is this true or not? And the other thing was that one of the conclusions they drew to my grandfather was that he was very much involved in agriculture and sitting and seating government, but was involved in agriculture his whole life. And the thought was that the exposure to the chemicals used in agriculture may have precipitated the disease and brought it on. I can take my answer off the air, and thank you very much.
Tim, thanks very much for your call. Let's start with what Tim was asking about. Does ALS skip a generation, which is something that he had heard?
Yes. So I think he's referring to familial ALS because sporadic ALS does not run through generations.
Right.
So in familial ALS, the most common gene is a gene called SOD1 or superoxide dismutase 1. And generally, when people have the gene, if they inherit the gene, they typically come down with the disease. So it does not typically skip a generation. But as I said, there are many other genes responsible for familial ALS. In some of those, it may appear to have skipped a generation because the person who harbors the gene may have died early, or that the gene has what's called a very weak expressivity or expression, so that it doesn't express till very late in the disease, in their lifespan. So, for example, in some people who may die at 40 or 50, they may not have reached the age where the gene may have expressed itself. But typically, if it's a genetic type of ALS, a person who harbors the gene comes down with the disease.
And how does that person get the gene? I mean, I'm revealing that I'm now forgetting my genetics, but is it a recessive gene? Is it something that if you have it from one side, you're definitely going to get it? How does that actually work in familial ALS?
That's a very good question. In the majority of instances, it is an autosomal dominant gene, which means that the gene can be transmitted by an affected male or female parent. It can be passed down to an affected male or female offspring. And with each pregnancy, the risk of the offspring harboring the gene is 1 in 2, or 50%.
We're going to get into the demographics here, Lisa, and I'd like to bring you back into the conversation in that. But Tim had another question that will help get us into some of the other possible theories behind why people get ALS. And if his grandfather did not have familial ALS, but in fact, one of the theories is that he was exposed to certain toxins, there is a theory that neurotoxins can cause ALS. Can you go into that, Dr. Tandon?
Yes, I think that those are mainly epidemiological studies, and they have been going on. We've had published studies now for maybe about 30 or 40 years or so that show an association between certain occupations and the development of ALS. This is non-familial ALS. So, for example, military personnel have a slightly higher incidence of ALS. They did in the Gulf War, the Persian Gulf War. People who are avid or active sportsmen may have a higher incidence of ALS, but that is sort of being contradictory in recent studies. People who work in farms, do heavy manual labor, may have a slightly higher incidence of ALS. Similarly, farmers and agricultural workers may have a higher incidence of ALS.
But these Which are is all, what Tim's grandfather was.
That's right. And these are all epidemiological associations. And we have to understand that epidemiological associations are not causative associations. So they are simply statistical relationships between certain professions and the development of ALS.
So this idea that neurotoxins may play a role, is that something that's still open to a lot of research?
It's completely open. In fact, it's a very viable idea and hypothesis being aggressively pursued.
And the other two, I understand there are four possible theories out there. So we've talked about familial ALS, which is carried genetically, and then this idea of neurotoxins, and there are a couple others.
Yes, and so the other is that could ALS be an immune-mediated disease where the body's immune cells destroy the motor neurons? And there is some evidence for that, but there's also a lot of evidence refuting that hypothesis. The other is that could ALS be due to a chronic infection, like a specific atypical infection? One agent that was reportedly associated maybe a few decades ago was polio, because polio produces a similar disorder. It also attacks the motor neurons. It also causes weakness and muscle weakness and atrophy. Many studies have shown that there really is no convincing evidence that polio causes ALS. But some other viruses may actually be implicated in ALS or some atypical kinds of ALS.
Lisa Anderson, there have also been concerns, going back to the neurotoxin idea, that people have raised about blue-green algae and a possible connection there. Are you hearing from people who are worried about that? Because that's certainly an issue we have in Vermont waterways.
I do hear about it from people, but not a whole lot. I think they don't know.
When you talk to families and look at who in Vermont and who elsewhere is getting this disease, Dr. Tandon talked a little bit about some of the populations that seem to have a higher incidence. Can you go a little bit deeper into that, the demographics of who gets this disease?
Sure. Right now in Vermont, we have about 60 people registered with our chapter. Those are people that we serve. And, you know, there's bound to be others that aren't registered. And then we also serve folks from upstate New York who receive their medical services at Fletcher Allen, and that's about 15 to 20 people. And it's men, it's women, it's people who have been farmers, it's people who have driven truck their whole life. It's veterans. Veterans are 60% more likely to be diagnosed with ALS, which is really scary.
And men are slightly more likely than women, is that right?
Yes.
And what about ages? Does it strike people at all ages, or do you see a preponderance of people in a certain time of life?
The age range is about age 40 to 70 with an average age of 55. But in our ALS clinic right now, I think the age range is around 28 to 85-ish.
So very young people sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking today about ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. If you have questions about this degenerative disease, we're going to get to more of those coming up in just a moment. We're talking about the potential causes for ALS. We're also going to look after the break into research being done to find a treatment for ALS, a cure for this disease that certainly has no cure at the moment. So please call with your questions, 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're learning from some experts in our region about ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. The disease now has a high level of name recognition thanks to the Ice Bucket Challenge. But the ways the disease affects patients is getting less press, so we're taking some time to understand it today. We're talking with Dr. Roop Tandon, a neurologist who researches and treats patients with ALS at Fletcher Allen Healthcare and the University of Vermont College of Medicine, and with Lisa Anderson, Vermont Care Services Coordinator for the ALS Association of Northern New England. And we're hearing from some of you with questions about ALS. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts and experiences on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's go to Tracy calling in from Stowe. Hi, Tracy. Go right ahead.
Hi. Well, thanks for taking my call, first of all, and for bringing up this really important discussion rather than just the bucket, the challenge. My question was, what is the difference? Because the symptoms sound very similar to muscular dystrophy. So I was kind of wondering what the difference is in the two diseases. And also, because I'm in the health and fitness profession, is there anything that can slow down the progression, physical therapy, exercise, massage therapy, So I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, Tracy, thanks for your call. Let's split this. Dr. Tandon, first of all, the differences between ALS and muscular dystrophy and other degenerative diseases.
Yes. So thank you for bringing up this question. So the symptoms may be somewhat similar between muscular dystrophy and ALS in that the major symptom is weakness. Now, the difference is that in muscular dystrophy, the primary disease is in the muscle, whereas in ALS, the primary disease is in the motor neurons or nerve cells that ultimately give rise to nerves that control muscle function. So that's one difference. The other is that in people with ALS, there are other features of, remember I talked about the two-tier motor system, the upper and the lower motor system?
Mm-hmm.
In ALS, there are features of involvement of the upper motor system clinically, which one can see. So when one taps reflexes of ALS patients, they are very brisk. They may have spasticity. They may have emotional lability. Now, those kind of things are not seen in muscular dystrophy. And then if one does testing, blood testing and electrical testing, a test what's called the EMG, electromyogram, one can very clearly differentiate between the involvement in ALS as compared to that in muscular dystrophies.
And Lisa Anderson, what about ideas about physical therapy or other ways to help people retain some of their physical function? You talked a little bit earlier about working with speech pathologists, so maybe you can tie in some of the ways that people get treatment to help deal with the symptoms of ALS.
Sure. Well, we have a certified center of excellence, an ALS clinic right here in at Fletcher Allen, which is absolutely wonderful, and it has a multidisciplinary team of providers, including speech and language pathology, physical therapy, occupational therapy. We have a spiritual liaison, a respiratory therapist, a nutritionist, a nurse, and Dr. Tandon, and Dr. Hare, and Dr. Wahid. And all of those providers, what they do is so important. There's a misconception that when a person has ALS that their muscles need to be exercised to regain, some function. But unfortunately, those muscles aren't going to come back to their original level of function. So, for example, with physical therapy, we try to focus more on range of motion and stretching.
Rather than strength training.
Right.
In terms of the treatment that people are receiving, is it mostly just ways to try to maintain some function while the disease takes its course, or are they also getting some kind of pharmacological treatment?
Yes, there is, and Dr. Tandon could probably answer this better than I, but there is a medication, the generic name is Riluzole, that extends life by 3 months, and it's extremely...
On average, or is that a specific?
That's on average. There is some research out there that if someone takes Riluzole in combination with attending an ALS clinic, that it can extend life up to a year. Riluzole is extremely expensive. It's around $2,200 a month. So if someone doesn't have insurance or doesn't have a prescription plan, it's almost unattainable.
We're going to get into a little bit more of the research into other drug treatments, and Dr. Tandon, I'd like you to expand on some of the research that's going into this disease. But before we do, let's go to Barbara, who's calling in from Lewis, New York. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead.
Well, hi. Thank you for taking my call. We did mention on the air already that...
Barbara, I'm having trouble hearing you. I'm going to take you out of this line for a moment and see if we can adjust your call to see what's happening, because we'll try to take you again. So, Dr. Tandon, while we listen to see if we can get Barbara's call, can you talk a little bit about the research, first of all, into medical treatments, that idea that there might be some medication that could help?
Sure. So, Lisa mentioned Riluzole, which is the only FDA-approved medication for ALS. And in the initial studies, it did prolong survival or lifespan by about 3 to 4 months or so. But more recent studies done in Europe and in the U.S. and in Japan show that when used early in the course of the disease, there may be a much more significant and prolonged effect, biological effect on the disease. So we encourage our patients to start treatment as early as possible in the course of the disease. Having said that, there are many other treatments that one can advise patients with ALS, and these are referred to as symptomatic treatments, treatments that improve their symptoms. So some patients may have, as I mentioned earlier on, emotional lability with inappropriate laughter or crying. There are medications available to treat that because they can be socially embarrassing for patients and families. They may have excessive salivation, with drooling. There are medications available to treat that. Of course, there are medications available to treat the depression and anxiety which they may get. Some of them get muscle cramps and spasms. There are medications available for that. And then one can treat some of the nutritional issues that arise in the course of the disease, and the breathing difficulties can be treated appropriately with appropriate devices.
But none of those are actually significantly slowing the progression of the disease or reversing it. Is that right?
So actually, not quite, because the biological effect of aggressive nutritional intervention and respiratory intervention is greater than the biological effect of the only approved medication of the disease. So I think that one has to do all three in tandem. So not only all four, I should say. So I recommend riluzole, make aggressive therapeutic treatments for symptomatic strategies, and then support them nutritionally, support them breathing-wise.
And the nutritional support, that's one of your areas of focus, that you have found patients need more calories, even though, as we were talking about with Lisa, they're having less motor function. So why do they need, have you found, more calories?
Yeah.
And why does that help to have more?
You're right. So you were thought that having more calories would be harmful to people. But as normal folks get ALS, and we found, and others have found, that they need about maybe 400 to 600 calories a day more. And that is partly because they have a condition called a hypermetabolic state. So they have a increasingly driven metabolism. So they burn a lot more calories than in a healthy person. They also use a lot more calories with physical activity. So for the same level of physical activity, they use a lot more muscle. So they burn a lot more calories. So their need goes up substantially as their disease comes along. In terms of why else they may have increased needs for calories, they have difficulty with breathing. So they are struggling to breathe. That uses calories. They have cramps in their muscles. That uses calories. They have to overcome stiffness in the muscles. That uses calories. So all those factors lead to an increased demand for calories in ALS patients. So if they can meet those calories by taking things orally, that is preferable, obviously. But if not, then we, in some patients, recommend a gastrostomy or a feeding tube to give them adequate nutrition and hydration so that their nutritional needs are met.
Let me pause there and go back to Barbara, who we have back on the phone. Hi, Barbara. Go right ahead.
Hi. Yes, again, thank you for taking my call. My question is in reference to, if we know that ALS has a 2 to 5 year time frame, why don't we get hospice involved in this? Because isn't that hospice's theme for care?
Barbara, thanks for the call. Lisa Anderson, what about the role of hospice with ALS patients?
We absolutely get hospice and palliative care involved very early on. And I regretfully didn't mention our palliative care nurse, Barbara, who attends every clinic as well and starts talking with people from diagnosis.
And so do patients typically have a knowledge of, I mean, the life expectancy is 2 to 5 years. And as the disease progresses, do they have a sense of timing? Because hospice usually gets involved when patients have, I think, 6 months or less of life expectancy.
Yes. People usually start with palliative care and then transition to hospice. I think it's probably a little more fluid with ALS because everyone is very individual as far as how long they're going to live and what their symptoms are and what parts of their body are affected.
Let's go to John, who's calling in from Royalton. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning or good afternoon. I'm a retired respiratory therapist for 37 years. I dealt with life support. And ALS patients can live an awful long time, a really long time. I remember going to a home to get a blood gas on a lady that had been on a machine for 13 years, another one 9 years, taking care of people who have been 5 years, and you got Stephen Hawkins, who's been on for quite a while too. And the problem with all that is that the ventilators aren't managed very well many times, and this can cause a lot of stress for the patient, and it costs a great deal of money. And I was wondering how you felt about maintaining these patients on life support for a long time.
John, thanks for your call. Lisa Anderson, go to you on that first.
Well, I would say that the majority, and I don't know why this is, but the majority of folks that I work with in Vermont choose not to go on a ventilator. They often choose non-invasive ventilation, a BiPAP. But when people do choose invasive ventilation, it definitely is very expensive, and it requires a lot of caregiving on the family's part. So your question again?
What are your thoughts about maintaining people on a ventilator for a long time? Because he's also mentioning Stephen Hawking, who, of course, is perhaps the most famous case of somebody living with ALS for a much longer time than the life expectancy.
Yeah, that's a difficult question to answer. I support whatever the family wants, basically.
Dr.
So,
Tannen,
yeah, I can maybe address that from my perspective as well, Jane. In Japan, patients with ALS are supported by the federal government in Japan in terms of their mechanical ventilation or ventilatory assistance, so that patients can live for 10 years, 15 years, 20 years or so. In the U.S., that's an issue because we have a problem in supporting mechanical ventilation. And as Lisa mentioned, there's a national group that looked at the decisions that patients make towards accepting mechanical ventilation, which is different from a BiPAP or non-invasive ventilation. So this is through a tracheostomy or a hole in the trachea. Only 3% of patients with ALS actually accept mechanical ventilation. So the majority accept non-invasive ventilation. And that's largely because, number one, there's a significant disruption in the life of individuals and families when they opt for mechanical ventilation. And as this caller said, it is costly. And there's a lot of resources needed to support that kind of activity. And also that non-invasive ventilation machines now have become very effective. So they do the job very well.
We just have a couple of minutes left. I want to squeeze in one more phone call, and then I want to ask you about funding for ALS research. Alan is calling from Burlington. Hi, Alan. Go right ahead.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I have a friend who's 46 years old. He's now 80 pounds and is having difficulty swallowing. And so he's limited to what he can eat and swallow and drink. And if he drinks something cold, the mucus gets into his lungs and creates problems. He's also losing his ability to reason and think. His long-term and short-term brain functions are going, and he's having all types of seizures. He's an ALS-ALD patient. Would you have any suggestion as to why these seizures and brain functions are happening?
Alan, thanks for the call. Dr. Tannen, just quickly, why might brain function be affected? Because we talked about how that's typically not associated with ALS.
So in some patients with ALS, there can be cognitive involvement. In a lot of patients with ALS, there can be what is called frontal executive functions that are impaired. So reasoning, judgment can be affected. So cognitive dysfunction or loss of function can happen in people with ALS, especially with advanced disease. With respect to this patient's body weight, I think that from the description, it appears that he is significantly nutritionally compromised, and that needs to be attended to.
Just in the time we have left, avenues for research that seem very promising and the ability to get that research done. We've seen a lot of money going to the ALS Foundation during this Ice Bucket Challenge, but this is a disease that typically affects very few people, and I'm curious if that's a challenge. So, Dr. Tannen, are you seeing the research being done that needs to be done?
Yes, there's research going on very aggressively all over the world, actually, in ALS. In fact, there are more research papers in ALS now than there ever were. We are doing a lot of research here in Burlington, Vermont, at our center. We've done a lot of research in the nutritional aspects of ALS and how best to manage that. We have done research into the epidemiology of ALS. We have just received funding to look at the epidemiology of ALS and see there's some increased incidence of ALS in the northern New England area. So we want to study that further in collaboration with Dartmouth Medical Center. There's research going on into the genetic aspects of disease as to what goes wrong with these genetic diagnoses, genetic patients that leads to the development of disease. And there are animal models that have been created from those abnormal genes in humans that are being studied more aggressively to see what the basic mechanism for disease production might be and how that can be circumvented.
Well, we'll stay tuned for that. Promising avenues of research going on right here in our region. Dr. Roop Tandon is a neurologist who researches ALS, and he is with Fletcher Allen Healthcare and the University of Vermont College of Medicine in Burlington. Lisa Anderson is Vermont Care Services Coordinator for the ALS Association of Northern New England. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Jane.
Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. There's a small select club in the state, and it's comprised of the people who voted in yesterday's primary election. Turnout for the vote was particularly low, but ballots were cast, and we had winners and losers, and some elections that are still too close to call. Here to update us is VPR's Bob Kinzel. Hi, Bob. Nice to talk with you.
Hi, Jane.
Let's start with the Republican governor's race. Scott Milne was the presumptive favorite heading into the election. Do the results give Milne the momentum he'll need facing incumbent Peter Shumlin?
Well, it certainly helps. There's no question that Scott Milne had a big victory last night in his first run for statewide office. He got about 70% of the vote in what essentially was a four-way contest. So I think he feels pretty good today about his race against incumbent Democrat Peter Shumlin. But he does start this race with some sizable challenges. One would be money. Milne has about $40,000 raised so far. Shumlin has raised over $1 million. That's a big, big difference. Now, I know that money isn't everything for a campaign, but most Vermont voters are not familiar with Scott Milne, and he needs money to get his message out. He also needs to wage a very active campaign with the news media to highlight his top issues. He will get a fair amount of coverage when some debates are held in the coming weeks. You and I will host a debate right here on VPR. These debates will help highlight his differences. But the question will be if Milne has enough time. He's got basically 10 weeks to become a household name in Vermont.
And he's certainly trying to position himself and that money issue as a positive, saying, you know, he is not beholden to other interests, special interests, and he's going to be running a lean campaign. So we'll see if that strategy plays out. Bob, as the primary day drew close, Libertarian Dan Feliciano was causing quite a stir by mounting a write-in campaign. He did get into the double digits in the Republican primary with that write-in campaign, and he's also going to be running in the general election as a Libertarian. So what effect might he have on Scott Milne?
Boy, this is the real wild card, I think, of this November election. As you mentioned, it appears that he got about 2,000 write-in votes yesterday, and it's about 15% of all votes in the Republican gubernatorial primary. That's a pretty strong showing. You know, mounting a write-in campaign is not an easy thing to do. And the fact that 15% of the voters wrote in Feliciano's name shows how well organized that effort was. So if I was Dan Feliciano, I'd be feeling pretty good today, and I'd have some momentum going into the general election.
Bob, the closest race of the day had to be the GOP primary for U.S. House. That was Mark Donca, Don Russell, and Donald Nolte. And as far as we know right now, the margin is very, very slim. So is there any talk of a recount by the second place finisher?
Not yet, but there could be. Right now, less than 100 votes separate the top two candidates, as you mentioned, Mark Donca and Donald Russell. Now, there are still 35 of the state's 275 voting precincts that need to report their results. But it's hard to imagine that this situation is going to change all that much in the next 48 hours. So if these results stand, then Donald Russell would be well within his legal rights to ask for a recount. I just don't know if he will. My guess is that he'll wait for that final tally. The official results will come out next Tuesday. And if the current 90-vote margin gets even smaller, he may very well ask for a recount. But we have to remember that whoever wins the primary faces an uphill battle against incumbent Democrat Peter Welch. Donca ran against Welch 2 years ago and he lost by roughly a 3-to-1 margin.
Boy, and going back to that money issue, that's certainly going to be an issue in that race as well, with the incumbent having a lot more money.
Absolutely.
Dean Corin is the progressive candidate for lieutenant governor, moving on to another race, but he also mounted a write-in campaign to get his name listed as the Democratic candidate. So how successful was Dean Corin in his approach to that?
I think he was very successful. At this point, there are just over 5,000 write-in votes in the Democratic race for lieutenant governor. Now, not all of them are for Dean Corin. As you mentioned, you know, some Democrats don't support Corin. Some Democrats wrote in Phil Scott's name. So we can't assume that all 5,000 votes are for Dean Corin. But an analysis of several towns shows that Corin received at least 75% of the write-in votes in those communities. So if this percentage holds up, he'll get around 4,000 write-in votes. And as we just discussed previously with Dan Feliciano, it's not easy to have a write-in campaign. And the fact that Corin got around 4,000 votes is very significant.
But what do you think that effect might have on the general election when he's going up against the incumbent, Phil Scott?
It's going to be a fascinating race. It's going to be a referendum on single payer. Corin strongly supports it. Phil Scott doesn't like the idea, but he wants to see the governor's final plan and how it'll be financed. Corin's candidacy divides the Democrats. Some Democrats, including Senate President John Campbell, support Phil Scott. At the same time, Governor Peter Shumlin is backing Dean Corin. So voters are going to have a real choice in this race of who they'd like to see the next lieutenant governor be.
And Bob, just quickly, when are the votes going to be certified?
They will be certified next Tuesday morning at 10 o'clock over at the Secretary of State's office.
Okay, and we'll keep you posted. And listeners, of course, you can find all of our extensive coverage of the primary at VPR.net. VPR's own Bob Kinzel, thank you for bringing us up to date on what's known so far from the primary results.
My pleasure, Jane.
And now it's time for your messages to Vermont Edition. Producer Sage Van Wing joins me to read some of your comments. Hi, Sage.
Hi, Jane. On Monday, we discussed the training that police officers receive in Vermont. A listener going by the handle Lost in Sight wrote, "The problem is that the police are not accountable to their communities. The idea that the police are hired by the community and are representing the interests of the community and should be therefore immunized against prosecution places the health and well-being of the entire community in the judgment of a single officer."
We also got a note from Leanne Toomey, chief of the UVM Police Department, who wrote to share her personal perspective. She says, in part, "I'd first like to say that the police profession hasn't done a very good job of educating the public we serve on what it's really like to be an officer. I believe the police should seize more opportunities to engage and listen. First, understand our service communities, and next, to inform and educate."
She goes on to say, "The art of managing my day is preparing for the worst while delivering the public safety service seamlessly, adjusting to the context and circumstances that cannot be trained for nor anticipated, and doing all this without being perceived as overtly aggressive. One only needs to read the national news from last week to see that two officers were shot and killed in the line of duty on what most people would view as routine motor vehicle stops. These incidents serve to remind me that there is nothing routine about my workday, and I don't know how to train for that."
Last week, we talked to a researcher at Penn State who had studied the causes of what is commonly referred to as brain drain, the flight of the highest young academic achievers from their rural homes to more urban areas.
A listener called N.E.K. Preacher wrote, "I think that's a real classist mistake, even to use the term brain drain. I'm a professional who grew up in Vermont and stayed. What I find living here are a whole lot of incredibly intelligent, thoughtful, hardworking, resourceful people who have brains that are amazing, but would be insulted by any statement that the brains are leaving."
All right, point taken. The researcher we spoke to, Kai Schaft, also understands, and he says, "I think this is very apt. The term brain drain is perhaps, unfortunately, the term most popularly used to describe the complex processes." Schaft quotes his colleague, Michael Corbett, who has argued that one way academic success and rural outmigration can be interpreted is as an inability on the part of leavers to, quote, "handle a complex and difficult life of entrepreneurial risk-taking, raising a family on limited resources, physical toil, and manual skills in the real world."
We also spoke last week to Northeast Kingdom writer Garrett Kaiser about his new book, Getting Schooled, which describes the year he returned to teaching at Lake Region Union High School. Vicky writes, "I missed having Mr. Kaiser as a teacher by 1 year. However, I've been touched by his understanding, empathy, compassion, and belief in his students' abilities to overcome the odds of growing up in a, quote, ghetto in the woods. Thank you, Mr. Kaiser, for bringing the realities and challenges faced by rural students from communities like Barton to light.
And finally, last week we spoke with Stowe resident R.J. Thompson, who was attempting to break the unsupported record for traveling the length of the Long Trail. Unfortunately, Thompson had to stop his hike 4 days into his attempt.
He wrote, "A slip on the descent down Bolton Mountain during Thursday's rain put a tremendous amount of torque on my left knee. Even so, I was able to finish the third day 8 miles ahead of record pace, but my knee deteriorated, and the condition of the trail resembled a small brook. I could deal with an injury or bad weather, but both at the same time crushed me."
Yeah, Thompson goes on to say, "My initial thoughts were of failure, but then I remembered the people I had met along the way and the relationships that formed throughout the training process. I'd do it all over again, even if I knew I would fall short, and I'm already looking forward to my next attempt."
And we're looking forward to hearing from you. Send us your feedback, write to Vermont Edition at vpr.net, or connect with us on social media. We're on Facebook and Twitter at Vermont Edition.
Thank you very much, Sage.
You're welcome, Jane.
And that wraps up today's show. Tomorrow, you may have gone out to farms this summer to pick your own blueberries or strawberries, but it did seem to you like you were doing all the work for the farmer. Well, it turns out that a pick-your-own-farm can actually be a lot of work in its own right. We're going to talk about the business of pick-your-own-farms, and you can send your questions to Vermont Edition at vpr.net. And join us for that conversation tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening today.